This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about anxiety and hypnotherapy with Sarah Stevens. So to start off, we've got a definition for hypnotherapy from dictionary.com, and that is the use of hypnosis as a therapeutic technique. And like many of the definitions for this, it sort of breaks down the two parts, what the hypno and what the therapy part is, rather than explaining in more detail like we will in the episode. The way I would expand on it is it's an incredibly useful type of therapy for people that have unhealthy patterns of behaviors or thoughts, anxieties. It can really help to break those down. One example is with smoking. The rates of effectiveness are really incredible for those that are trying to quit. And that works in a way where people are taken into this hypnotic state, which is similar to sleep, like a deep relaxation. From there, the therapist can make suggestions or can kind of repeat mantras and use different techniques that they will have discussed previously with the client to try and break down these patterns. And that's incredibly useful, not just for breaking the patterns that you know. So if, for example, there are certain situations that trigger your desire to smoke, those can be tackled in a very direct way. So you may not even realize all the ways in which your day-to-day life reminds you of smoking and that kind of habit, but those habits can still be broken, because hypnotherapy is communicating with these habits on a more instinctual and subconscious level.
You know, I would have always associated it really with things like smoking. I just thought that it was more about things like that, because I think that they're the things that you hear commercially or, you know, on TV and film, that it is used to treat so many other things, including mental illnesses like anxiety, which we'll obviously learn a lot more about in the episode. That intrigued me really.
For sure, definitely. It is one of the approaches to therapy I know less about, but partly for that reason, I'm really intrigued by it and was delighted to get to delve into that. But you're absolutely right. It has results for a lot of people that are really transformational for conditions like anxiety. Again, it comes back to that, those habits that we have, that certain things may trigger people's anxiety and they may not even realize what those are. Equally, other anxiety conditions like PTSD, which we covered last week, it can be really incredible for that, because this type of approach doesn't necessitate getting to all the root causes in the same way as other types of counselling and therapy may do. So there could be things that trigger your PTSD symptoms that you don't even realise. And particularly with a condition like that, there may have been things your mind has blocked out. You know, there's been things that you're unaware of as a kind of defense mechanism that our minds have. And so there might be something that reminds you of a traumatic event and you don't even realize. You may not even remember that, but it could still make you feel incredibly anxious. So I think it can be really incredible for that reason. And that's why it's often recommended as a way to work through the day-to-day coping with things that may trigger you, whilst you're going through the longer process, usually, of getting past the trauma. You know, this can kind of help deal with the day-to-day coping whilst you deal with the longer-term impact separately. So it's often for that reason described as complementary counselling.
Absolutely. That's a brilliant way to put it. I was going to say that you've just hit the nail on the head. Yeah, it deals with those behaviours that are active when those thoughts come in, or, you know, those real flashbacks of memory that can trigger then other symptoms, as opposed to getting to the root of, you know, it all. And I think I've often maybe been a little bit unsure when I have read or looked into hypnosis. And it was great because our guest is so credible. And I think that was really important for us. We've been in the field for over 20 years. So it was quite important, actually, for me. I felt it was, and maybe that's just my own, you know, my own personal reason talking about it, I was open to it.
Right, that's very honest. We all have those kind of suspicions that often come from not understanding. In the same way, I think people don't understand other types of a therapeutic approach. I think often terms like talking therapy can be quite deceptive because people use that term and they think, oh, you go to counselling and you talking to each other is where all the change comes. But it's actually what's happening behind those words, what you're figuring out, how to articulate the connections you're making, the things that the counsellor is bringing to the surface with you. It's not really comparable with a normal conversation. And so talking can be quite a deceptive word.
Yeah.
In the same way, I think with this, hypnosis is a term that many people associate with like Darren Brown and with like magicians. You know, that's where often we come across that term. But just like talking, conversations can come in a whole range of situations, as can hypnosis as a technique. So two more things to mention for this. First off, we've got a stat from Mental Health First Aid England on prevalence of anxiety in young people. This is something that comes up in the interview, as Sarah was experiencing anxiety from a very young age. And they found that in 2017, 3.9% of 5 to 10-year-old children had anxiety disorders, as did 7.5% of 11 to 16-year-olds, and that then rose to 13.1% in 17 to 19-year-olds. So I found that stat incredible to read. Sadly, it doesn't surprise me, that level of prevalence. But if you compare the first one, 3.9%, to them rising to 13.1% for 17 to 19-year-olds, it shows you how critical supporting mental health in children is. That there can be this misconception that these things all crop up when you're an adult. Often the challenges you come across in adulthood can bring up more of these issues that are already pre-existing. That, you know, anxiety may be something you're living with and you've learned to cope with, perhaps through school, and then you go through the life change of going to university, which is very different, or going into the workplace, and then the way you've been coping is maybe no longer enough, or you have additional pressures that bring these problems to a surface level where you can't just get by anymore. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely, which is why our campaign for mandatory mental health education in schools is absolutely pivotal, really, really important, because you're right. And I also think it's worth mentioning that we all experience anxiety symptoms through even adrenaline, right? The whole feelings that we call and label anxiety now is something that each of us will experience on completely different levels at completely different times. And I just think that the education and the early intervention around understanding what that is will just help us manage that later on in life, not just for young children who are presenting with anxiety symptoms, but for everybody.
Right, absolutely. We can all feel anxious at different times in our life, and that is quite normal. But we also need to know what to do when that becomes something that upsets our day-to-day living and becomes more than just situational anxiety, but instead a full-blown condition.
Absolutely.
And that's something we touch on a bit with our guests as well, how that kind of developed and where it was manageable in her life and where it wasn't.
And she also talked about more and more of her clients are actually children now.
For sure. Which, in a way, I try and find a positive in as well, that they are getting the help, and that's really important. Not all of them are, but it's good to hear when more children are accessing support as well.
Absolutely.
And so on a different note, the very last thing we have to mention is by the time this episode goes out, there'll be only 10 days left to our first ever live podcast recording. So that has come around quite quickly. January seems to have gone faster than normal. I find it usually kind of drags, but maybe it's that we've had that to look forward to.
Yeah, it hasn't dragged actually at all, has it? It's gone really quickly. I think it has.
If listeners haven't heard us mention the live show yet, it is basically where we'll be recording the podcast in London, in Shoreditch, in front of an audience, so you can all come along and get tickets. Hopefully there's still some left, and the link for that is on our website and in the episode description as well. We'll be interviewing not just the usual one guest, but instead a panel of three guests around the theme of recovery, So they'll be talking about different conditions, different life experiences, and what they've learned through their journey. So it should be really inspirational, really fascinating. I'm so delighted with the lineup that we've got, which you can, of course, read up more on. And we'll also have audience Q&As. So if you ever find yourself listening and you have burning questions that maybe I've missed, this is your chance. And we'll have a live musical performance to close out the show on kind of upbeat note. So I'm really looking forward to that. And of course, it will be great to meet as many of you guys there as possible. So do get tickets if you haven't already before they run out. Thank you in advance. Anything you want to say, Danielle?
No, I'm just so excited. Excited to meet some of the listeners. I know loads of people are out there buying tickets. So yeah, please go get online and buy some tickets. But Bob and I are really looking forward to meeting everybody. I'm really excited about it, Bobby. You know, three guests will be a juggling act. It's going to be a challenge for us, and we're really looking forward to
I wonder if that's a selling point. If people want to see me out of my comfort zone, come along to the show. you'll see all the live bits. You'll see all the like joking around in between. You'll see where like we forget what we're saying. There's loads that conveniently gets cropped out by our wonderful producer, Pete. You'll get to see the full and unfiltered mental podcast.
Yes, true, actually, Bob. We haven't even discussed that. I'm really, like, excited about it all. It'll be great. However, we know that when we're recording for the normal podcast, we're, like, know that everything can get cropped and we can miss things, we can have coughing fits, your cat can, like, mess us up, we can get words wrong, and we know that it's all going to be edited and smooth, but this, no. Bye.
Yeah,
but
so
real and authentic, you know, it's going to be really good.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So, yeah, we're very excited about that. I think that's all I have to say. We're just buzzing for it. So we'll get into the episode with Sarah Stevens in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out. We all deserve to further our knowledge. That's why we have partnered with The Great Courses Plus. Founded on the belief that education should be accessible to all, their streaming service gives teaching from experts you'd never otherwise have access to. This includes professors from universities like Harvard and Yale, or specialists from organisations like the National Geographic. You'll get unlimited access to thousands of in-depth courses in video or audio formats. For example, I'm currently working through cognitive behavioural therapy, techniques for retraining your brain. This course not only gives you a thorough background on CBT, but also teaches you many of the tools you can use to better manage your emotions. I'd really recommend joining me in taking this course or checking out The Great Courses Plus in general. Plus, we have a limited discount for our listeners, 50% off if you sign up for a 3-month plan. You just have to use our link, thegreatcoursesplus.com/health. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/health. Linked in the description. Please support them as they support us and let us know how you get on.
Hi, I'm Sarah Stevens. A little bit background about me. I have suffered from severe anxiety and social phobias for my early part of my life. I came from a very troubled background and had a lot of childhood issues, which was quite difficult. I'm highly dyslexic, which was undiagnosed, probably wasn't seen in those days. I had a speech impediment and didn't really start communicating until I was probably maybe 7 or 8. So I think when I was born in 65. So at that time in school education, I think they just sort of went, oh, it's just a bit dumb, you know, and they just pop you at the back of the class in the hopes that you're able to sort of like resurface from, you know, that, or just at least go along with it, which was fine. And I think then for a lot of time, school wasn't great for me. And I was obviously, you know, highly anxious. So that wasn't great either. There was a few events in my life that really did make a big transition. Leaving school was probably one of the best things I ever did. But it gave me a chance to reset myself in a new place where people didn't see me as the person who wasn't really good at things, you know.
Right, so, and before we get into leaving school, it's interesting what you said there about school, in particular dyslexia, because that's something I deal with myself. And it seems to come up with a lot of our guests. And I've looked into it and there's not a huge amount of research around it. I'm not suggesting maybe there's a link between dyslexia and mental illness necessarily, but I wonder if for many people, it's adding to your struggle in early life is enough to kind of tip you over into certain conditions.
Yes, it'd be something I'd love to try and study a little bit more. Sort of a dyslexic mind is a very, you know, is a mind that struggles to focus fully on things in a clear mm-hmm. way. So I do think there's possibly some level of linkage with that, but a very interesting topic to try and explore maybe for somebody, but a complex one, definitely.
Sure. And at that time, you've mentioned about having anxiety from a young age at school.
Yeah.
Were you aware of what it was or just aware of the symptoms?
I wasn't really aware of it at all. I think because of my background, I was a little bit, you know, disconnected from myself. So I think I just managed to just get through things, really. Right. I think the trigger points came later on that made me very aware of my symptoms that then pushed me into, you know, the more severe anxieties that I experienced after then. I think anxiety, we can live in denial of our anxiety, really, and, you know, we just sort of try to cope with it. But I think this is where, for a lot of people who come to see me anyway now, is that they come and they go like, well, this has just come from nowhere. I was absolutely fine one day and bang, this panic attack and my whole life's turned around. And, you know, and I think for the majority of people I speak to, it isn't just that one thing that happened that one day. It's been beneath the surface. This was one trigger that pushed these things to the surface. And a bit like Pandora's box, really, once the lid's off,
right,
you're standing fully in that. And it, and then it's like, oh, what are we going to do with this?
It's like people reach a point where they can't deny it anymore.
Yeah.
And one trick I've learned with that is when you speak to somebody and they talk about anxiety just coming out of nowhere, if I ask them something like, were you a worrier before that? They always were. Like, there was always some other word they rationalised it under.
Yeah. And I think that's that denial part of it, isn't it? That I think we all probably don't want to face our fears. Facing fears is probably not our natural instinct, you know. We're always trying to avoid fearful events, going back to the more primitive sides of ourselves. Don't get around things that are going to, like, eat you or scare you to death. Mm. So I think culturally we're quite happy to try and avoid fearful things, and I think that can be an issue when our anxiety is starting to grow within us because we're not actually facing it. And then when it gets to that point, yeah, it then pushes us to a whole nother level. Difficult then.
Yeah.
Find our way back from that point.
Exactly. That's why I was thinking you then have the challenge of trying to trace it back.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned earlier about leaving school and that was kind of a fresh start.
Yeah.
You'd not got qualifications particularly from it, but
no.
You were going into a new world that yes. was less academic. So how did that go?
Well, that was fantastic for me. It gave me an opportunity to show that I could do things without having that academic side. And I started off as a office junior in a state agency office. And I think the thing sometimes, you know, when you're an anxious person, we can sometimes get a little bit obsessive about things, can't we? Like things in order and like to do these things. It often comes with a lot of anxious people. And I remember they had like a basement area and I used to have to go down there to print off the details then. It wasn't, they didn't have the technology you had now, so you used a photocopy of things. And mm-hmm. they went, well, all these things are in here. These are all the properties. It's just a box. I'm like, what, no order? I'm like, here's all the photos in another big box. What? So I'm like, well, this is not going to suit me, you know. So, and obviously, it was a mammoth task to dig through this box and then find the right pictures to go on the right things. Just really stressful. And I'd said to one of them, are you using these planning files over here or this? And they were like, oh, no. So I then spent a lot of time and I organised everything into that right. chronological order. They all were organised. And the whole, you know, behind the scenes production of that, you know, estate agency office transformed. There was two office juniors and eventually they only needed one, you know. So for me, being able to put my, you know, anxious need to having everything in a good place actually made me feel, you know, that level of self-worth, you know, that I could be worthy of, you know, doing something really good without obviously having that level of qualification. So that was fantastic for me, you know.
And it also sounds like it was an opportunity to use that like intense focus that the anxiety could give you to do something proactive.
Yeah.
And you then, by the sounds of it, were feeling a lot more in control once things were better organized.
Yes, I felt a lot happier then because it was more streamlined and it felt more comfortable. And one of these people, I don't know why, I just don't like wasting time, you know, and you just think, that's such a waste of time to dig through that. Nobody else before me, I've just been quite happy to do that. But for me, yeah, I don't know. I think we all have a different qualities and things we like and we don't like, and wasting time is one not for me, really. So that, coupled with the other stuff, really made me want to home in and create that, you know, that better order, which transformed how things ran.
Yeah, that's interesting. It seems like you really had a sense of self even forming from that point, because it's quite clear you're priority for efficiency and all the work you do now, that you wouldn't be able to achieve it all if you were happy to sort of do things in a slightly backwards way.
No, definitely. I think, you know, I am a bit of a perfectionist. I like to do things right. And yeah, and I think that's the quality that does come into my work side, because I like to do the best that I can for everybody that I see, you know. I'm not just going through the motions.
So through this new experience with the estate agent, you were finding comfort there, you know, it was suiting your approach. It sounds like your dyslexia wasn't causing as much of an issue. How do you think your anxiety was at that point?
I think my anxiety was a lot better, you know. I felt better as an individual. It gave me a level of a bit of self-worth, really, because I think if you're not doing very well at school and you're dyslexic, you just don't feel great about yourself, because at school everything's measured by achievement. If you're not achieving, then where do you put yourself on the scale? Whereas when I started in the estate agency, it gave me a level of, you know, connection that I was a worthy component in this, that I had something to offer, you know. And it didn't matter if I couldn't spell or write brilliantly, it wasn't important. I think that's a big thing with being dyslexic, isn't it? And I think that's what I see with a lot of dyslexic children, is they just feel so uncomfortable about their abilities that it enables them, you know, to then compound that lack of inner safety and security within themselves. So everything's based from a place of insecurity, because, you know, they haven't felt secure, because who wants to be the odd one out? Everybody else is fine and you're not. So, you know, you're basing everything from quite an uncomfortable place. So I don't think you're able to find that platform within yourself to develop that inner safety and security. And if you haven't got that, you're searching for it outside of yourself, which then becomes quite an issue for your anxiety, because you're always looking for something to validate you,
right,
instead of you being able to go, you know what, I think I'm great as I am, you know. There, you're always searching for something. Might make you quite successful, because you're busily, you know, and it did for me in the estate agency. I became quite successful in it because I was always looking for that next goal to validate me. Oh, I've done that one. Oh, great. Okay. Oh, right. I need another goal, because otherwise, if you haven't got a goal, then you've got time to, you know, be more anxious. And also, you've then, that label that somebody gave you a month ago, it's sort of wearing off, isn't it? You know, nobody's telling you again, oh, you're great, and you don't feel great inside, so you search for another thing to make yourself feel great again.
Right, and if you don't do that, you're allowing time for introspection.
Yeah.
Which, with the anxiety, it can really fester in that.
Yeah, definitely.
But another thing you mentioned there, which I really like, is talking about how it thrived in the school environment. Mm-hmm. I think at times a lot of people don't understand that, with there being such a rise in anxiety in young people. But actually, if you break down how the schooling system works, it's a really comfortable environment for anxiety to dwell. The exams and the time scale, I think, of a lot of that. If you've always know when your next exam is, and then if you're in the position like you were of having dyslexia, it's not just an exam, that's your next failure.
Yeah.
And you know what date it is. That's going to get you incredibly worked up.
Yeah, that whole self-fulfilling prophecy you're setting in place, aren't you? And I think schools struggle, I think, in being able to have probably enough resources to be able to deal with the amount of children that they have in classrooms as well, and to have children have all the probably individual attention that some children need. And I think teachers, as I know quite a few, they're quite anxious and stressed, and that anxiety and stress is, I think, being fed through into the children as well, and needs to be the person who, you know, gets the higher grade, who does the right thing. And I think that's only a small percentage of us who are going to get the A star, you know. Lots of us aren't, so.
Right, and in fact, that's the way it's set up, that most of the grade boundaries are set in a way that only a set percentage can get that grade.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking that when I was younger, and at times I could be a bit resentful of it, and partly because of having dyslexia myself. You know, I looked at people in other schools, or like friends of mine that were doing like extra GCSEs because they were really academic and they could. And I thought, well, that's pushing up the grade boundaries for the rest of us that are struggling to do the minimum amount.
No, I agree. And I think obviously that just makes it more uncomfortable for the people who aren't able to achieve those levels. And obviously, you know, it's great if you can come out with lots of qualifications, but it doesn't mean that you're going to do great things with them. You know, some people might, but there are lots of other qualities we need, but they're not being valued or quantified in a school environment. So, you know, we can't say, oh, well, being really organised, or, you know, ultra efficient like I was, you know, I didn't get a qualification for that. So even though it actually was the thing that springboarded me into a great career at that time, but I wasn't being measured by that. I was being measured by whether I could spell and couldn't, you know.
And in that way, you're kind of set up to fail.
Yeah.
It is fascinating, because I often say that to people, that the thing I learned most from school was social interactions, you know, getting along with people and being able to relate to people from a whole range of different backgrounds. You know, that arguably applies far more to a job like this than any maths lesson I did.
Yeah, that's fine.
So it's interesting how we all get different things from it, and yet that's not really acknowledged by the schooling system.
No, and I think, again, it's resources, isn't it? There's only so much that can be, you know, can be taught. And I think, you know, everything's brought about to a numbers game, isn't it? You know, every child has to come out being able to hopefully write and spell and add up. And, you know, I don't think there's the time to do that. But maybe there needs more time to be able to, you know, acknowledge some of the other attributes that, you know, are necessary in making a well-rounded person, you know, and an academic size of ourselves are only just one side.
Mm-hmm. So coming out of that experience, you're in the estate agent, and at least career-wise, things are going better. And how was your mental health developing?
I was still in that point of denial with my mental health. I think the career gave me an opportunity to have another distraction that enabled me to throw myself into something. And, you know, I became, you know, assistant area manager. I became a valuer. I had 8 branch offices. I had, you know, 50 members of staff. I was, at that time, I remember being the only woman valuer, and there was 60 other guys. That was a challenge, you know, at those times, but one that I enjoyed, because it didn't give me any time to worry. I was too busy, you know, being absorbed doing other things.
Right.
And I think it was only as that progressed and I had a few other life issues come my way that it really started to trigger my anxiety, because I became more aware of the disparity of my life, that my life was very full with work. And, you know, I was toppling over with the pressure of that, and the other sides of my life, the social sides of life, were probably not that great, really. Because I think you've only got so much time in a day, haven't you? So getting up early, having to be there first, because I was the boss, you know, and then having to get home, and it wasn't that much time to be able to then have that more social side of my life. And that's when I think things started, the cracks were appearing then.
For sure. And it's very easy to hide from yourself.
Yeah.
In so much work.
Sure.
And with your career being so great on paper, well, how could there be an issue? Because everything's going so well for her.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so those cracks that you describe, when did they become more apparent?
I was in an armed robbery, actually. I was locking up and a couple of young lads came with crash helmets on and a knife and bundled me back into the office, because at that time a lot of estate agents had a little building society, like little branches in there, and had to open the safe and give them the money. And so it was quite a traumatic time and experience for me at that point. And that really did blow the lid off my anxiety, because then at that point I had to face the feelings, because even being able to get outside was a struggle for me after that. You know, you always... that was there in the dark, and you know, you don't expect these things to happen, and then before you know it, you're looking over your shoulder all the time, you don't feel comfortable anymore. And that was a real massive turning point for me, where I couldn't keep a lid on my anxiety, and it started to get a lot worse at that point.
Right. And I can see how potentially as well it sort of validated the anxiety feelings, because so often that's you imagining the worst case scenario.
Yes.
And this happened, you know, something that you would dread, and I'm sure you go through training for if it ever happened, and then it did.
Yeah. And then obviously, they were lovely and supported me, and obviously I had to get back to work and I continued in that way. But as I said, I was starting to really see a lot of cracks in who I was, and I hadn't really done anything to try and deal with my issues at that point. But then obviously I couldn't hold that banner up anymore. I still wasn't ready to deal with my anxiety, but obviously at that point I was really struggling more with it. So, you know, on a day-to-day basis it was quite a challenge. I think then further down the line it just continued, you know, on a level to, you know, be increasing sort of more. And I think I got to a turning point in my life where I just think, why was I doing all of this? I sort of run out of goals. I was assistant area manager. I was mid-20s. There wasn't many more goals, you know, to achieve. And that was, I think that's when the wheel fell off, really. And life was not going great for me. And I went down some really negative routes and ended up, you know, just giving it all up, and I went and travelled around the world. Did something totally different, because again, just like all the other things that I was doing, I was searching for happiness outside of myself again. So no, if it wasn't going to be work, then it was going to be doing something else. So off I travelled around the world.
It was like you were going through a mental list of all the excuses that are things outside of my own head.
Yes, yeah. If I can do this, then this will make me happy. You know, as lots of us do, you know, when we have anxiety, and when we are painfully insecure inside, we spend all of our time searching for that external validation. And that was clearly me, you know, very much so. I had an amazing time, you know, it was great, you know, to be a hippie and travel around Thailand for 8 months, living on hippie islands and, you know, meeting different people. And it got me into hypnotherapy because I had some books that I was reading. I was reading about, you know, all that stuff like Uri Geller and, you know, all those very interesting stuff about, like, predictions and mind control. And, yeah, some really fascinating stuff because I wasn't working. So I had just a lot of time on my hands to, you know, read and talk to people. I spent a couple of weeks living in a true Buddhist monastery, where there was no communication whatsoever. We just did meditation. It was a little detached little villa. It was a proper Buddhist monastery. We were lucky to get in there. Just practiced meditation every day. That was it. You know, no radio, no books, no communication, no talking, no writing, no nothing, you know. Quite mind-blowing, really. I found one of the most fascinating things is that I did keep a little secret journal, which I wasn't supposed to do anyway. It was more about, there was nothing to talk about in the day because I was just busy standing or lying or sitting or walking. But my whole world turned upside down because my daytime felt like the night and my night was like the day, because I was having like 20 or 30 dreams every night. Really powerful, because I think there was so little to do in the day that I became so much more aware of the night time. It's quite fascinating. I read my dream journal a few weeks ago and I was clearing out a cupboard and I was just like dream after dream, you know, and it was just a really interesting experience, which I think at that point really made me realise that, you know, there were so many things that I really needed to sort out. I was a heavy smoker. I drank too much, as well as my anxiety. I think at that point it was like, I need something. I tried some traditional therapy, you know, two or three years before then, like counselling and a bit of psychotherapy, but it really hadn't made an impact on me at all, you know. It just seemed to validate the fact that I couldn't resolve these issues. So I decided then that I was going to, you know, explore the hypnotherapy route, and for me, it was life-changing, which is, you know, fabulous.
That's brilliant. And you ended up going back to education then?
Yes. Well, when I got back from travelling, I'd found a course that I wanted to do and I started it. And that was great. You did a lot of practice then because I went down to London to do this. But I'd started. And that time, everybody was like, well, you've obviously gone crazy by travelling. Who's going to learn to be a hypnotherapist? That's a really weird thing to do 28 years ago. But for me, it was a great thing because you met a lot of people, you did a lot of training, you worked on yourself, and it was really a brilliant thing. And I found for me, it's the only thing that had seemed to work to help with my sort of anxieties and to really help me try and understand what I was struggling with inside. So yeah, it's transformational.
That's brilliant, because that's something that I think a lot of people won't know about if you've not been through that process, is how introspective you're forced to be. That unless you really actively work through your own background, then it's going to be almost impossible for you to know at certain times when a client makes you feel a certain way, whether that's you're empathising with their feelings or whether that's something that's come up from your own past.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I think for me, it was one of the most important sides of my development. And again, this comes back to me being a complete perfectionist. You know, I wasn't happy if there was any level of transference. There's no point me not dealing with who I am or being the best version of myself and then trying to help somebody else do it. It's like, it's not going to work, is it? You know, if I can't be a, you know, a clear channel and actually show people the mirror of transformation that these things can offer, I'm not sure how I could do what I do, you know. So I do see now all my past and the things that I went through as a way of helping me understand people. And in doing that, I have this unconscious connection with people, that people can resonate with me on a deeper level. And in my work, I think there's that lovely connection that people can have with me, that they can feel, you know, if I can change and transform from where I've been, that they can too.
Right. And I think that's a fascinating part of the therapeutic process, that I imagine a lot of your clients feel more similar to you as time goes on because of building that connection, that even though you won't be talking much, if any, about your own experience, they'll feel that because of your understanding, there's a lot of similarity there.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, and I think that's how people see that. Some people I'm happy to tell them, because some people maybe need to hear that, you know, I've been in dark places and had difficult times, and that is a comforter for some people. But for a lot of people, as I said, there's just that deeper connection that they can gain.
Right. And so hypnotherapy isn't something we've specifically covered on the podcast, although we've had a hypnotherapist on before, Richard Nichols. Could you talk us through how that process starts with you and a new client?
Sure. For me, everybody's different. So the sessions are always going to be bespoke. I think it's very much about finding what we need and then using hypnotherapy as a tool to try and help us reset ourselves. I think for a lot of us, our issues, we could get over to a point, but because of the power of our unconscious mind, we're being dragged back by the habits and patterns and the emotions that we store from the past. And they're the things that stop us from moving forward. Consciously, for a lot of us, like probably yourself going through your life as well, you were quite aware of what you wanted to do, just couldn't do it, you know. And I think that's the pleasure of hypnotherapy. It's not just about helping us understand ourselves on a conscious level. It's giving us that reboot, that kickstart. So initially for people, I would normally have people in for like an initial consultation just to make sure there's the right dynamic and I felt that I could help them. Then in the first session, we'd take a little bit more history. And then I'd normally say to them, well, you know, if I could wave a magic wand, how do you want to feel, you know? And then I'd find out from their own language, because I think everything has to be in your own language, what they want to be feeling, because obviously we all talk about ourselves and how we want to feel in quite different ways. So I'd write some very scruffy notes, but enough that I could read. And then I'd put down all what's called their direct suggestions and we'd start on that route. We'd then spend probably about 40 minutes in hypnosis using those direct suggestions. So just use deep relaxation and then, you know, direct suggestion or whatever approach that I'm delivering. I use a very simple technique. I record that for them. They take that away. They take a memory stick with a range of other recordings on. Bit of input and output, really. They need to start putting some good stuff in. So they would use that at home in between the sessions. Then, depending what they've come for, obviously if they come for stop smoking, one session is normally enough, you know. Anything more than that, they need a few more sessions and I'm never sure where that's going to go. There's a lot of different approaches that I can deliver from using some reprocessing, some desensitization, you know, EMDR. Inner child work, they could do some journeying, some visualizations. Normally the right approach will find its way to the surface for them.
Right, and in many ways that sounds very compatible with this type of work, that you're not going in with your set agenda, you're letting it be so led by the client.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating to me. It's not a type of therapy I've gone through myself. And as you've described it there, I've really got the parallel in my head of how you had that experience with the monastery and you took that time out. And even when you were describing that, it almost sounded like you were having a, what I was thinking of as like a mental fast, that it was the first time in your life you were really taking a step back, really clearing your mind and finding out what's left when you try and do that, when all the other distractions are away.
Yeah.
You were finding all these dreams you were thinking about that maybe you didn't even allow yourself time to remember because you were just so focused on everything else.
Yeah.
And I see a lot of parallel with hypnosis and that.
Definitely. And I use that approach with a lot of people because, you know, we do dream for 2 hours every night, even if we don't remember them. So I use something called EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And I use that quite a bit to help people shift from...
And could you break that down in case people aren't familiar with
that? Yeah. It's part of the rapid eye movement state. It's just an eye movement where your eyes will move from side to side, normally for about 20 to 30 seconds at different intervals throughout the night.
And so for context, when people are dreaming, that's usually the eyes moving.
Yes, from side. Yeah, you can see, if you close your eyes, you can see people's eyes move from side to side if they're accessing that rapid eye movement state. So hypnosis is the closest state you're ever going to have a waking dream. So it's the closest connection you're going to get to be able to be consciously or semi-consciously aware of what's happening deep within your mind. So no point trying to reinvent the wheel. We might as well use the strategies that our mind uses already and throw our issues back into our mind and get our mind to see them from a different way. So the reprocessing has a really amazing way of being able to deal with this. I use the technique a lot with people with PTSD, with post-traumatic stress disorder, because, you know, they're very stuck in the trauma and the trauma just keeps replaying itself like a record in the background. And until we're able to let that go or see it in a different way, then that cycle of trauma just continues. So being able to use EMDR is fantastic for that. And it's fantastic for anxiety as well.
Right. And I just want to pause on that because that's a great point about PTSD, that you're tapping right into where the PTSD can often fester. That for many people, they, as they get better, they're getting less triggered while they're awake, but they could still be having nightmares. And sometimes you need an approach like this to really tackle the nightmares at the root. Is that right?
Definitely. I think, you know, for PTSD is a very complicated sort of issue, and you've got, you know, complex PTSD and standard PTSD. And for a lot of it, you know, in that moment of trauma, we disconnect from a part of ourselves. As we move on after that trauma, depending how big the trauma is, depends how we're able to function. That, you know, can fester really badly within us. And over time, that can build up into quite a lot of anxiety and emotional issues, because it's just sort of growing within us and there isn't an outlet for us. That compounding of it just grows.
Yeah. And if you are having that unresolved trauma just going on subconsciously, then I can see very clearly how you're going to be waking up every morning and not feel that you've rested properly.
Yeah.
And yet there's not always that clear link unless you go to someone like yourself to explore it.
Yeah, I think definitely. I think particularly in Britain anyway, we're very British stiff upper lip, aren't we? You know, it's only when I started doing more travelling when I was sort of younger, and you go to meet different cultures and you think they're so much more expressive. I should have been born in Italy, really, or France or somewhere else where, you know, you could have an argument with somebody and they would actually say, and then you could, you know, hug it all out and it'd all be great. But I think in Britain, we're not getting better, but we're very used to just pretending everything is okay, you know, and people might say, are you fine? Oh, yes, I'm fine. But actually inside, no, we're not fine at all. So that suppression of things in Britain is quite sort of difficult when it comes to things like trauma, because we then don't feel able to have an outlet to be able to let go of these feelings and emotions. And I think also not only about Britain, but I think our whole evolution as a species, you know, if we look back 100 years, we were born and died in a 12-mile radius. Our world was so small that, say, if we lived in a village and we'd had a bad time, everybody would know we'd have a bad time. So we could probably go off and, you know, have a bit of an issue, you know, shout, scream. We had an outlet for those feelings.
Right, because what I'm hearing there is overall that's a really good comparison, because your locus of control only needed to be a certain size. Whereas nowadays we're so used to our globalised world that international news that may not directly affect us at all could still affect our mood for the whole day or the whole week quite easily.
Definitely.
And yet that's not something we can fix, whereas in that more it was a more tribal way of living, the issue was, you know, somebody the other side of the block, and you could either deal with it or you could walk away from them.
That was the whole caveman part. And obviously we need to be aware also that obviously back in that caveman time, you know, we lived on that fight or flight response. It's the thing that's made us the most overpopulated species on the planet. If we didn't have it, we would never have survived. We would have run back in the cave and gone like, no, it's a grizzly bear, we're not going out again. So it's a great thing. And it was back then. And it has enabled us to be who we are now. But, and your point, as you said earlier, about the news, you know, and all these things that happen, at, you know, outside of us that we can see going on around us, they're not happening close to us. It's not something we can hold. So we actually probably live in the safest time in England anyway than we've ever lived. We're not fighting. Hopefully a lot of us have got homes and food and shelter and all those things that we need to survive without any need to, you know, to fight people. So what do we do with that primeval part of our mind? What's it, just switch off? No. And that is one of our major issues with anxiety, is that that part of our mind doesn't have anything to do. So if you haven't got anything to be anxious about, truly a real-life threat, that's how we get phobias. How many people have got phobias about things where you just think, well, why? You don't need that phobia. It's not. Lots of people have snakes or even spiders. Well, the spider, it's teeny. It's not going to kill you. But, you know, our mind and that primeval part of our mind needs to have something to do. So it's often going down those routes of creating these fears and anxieties, because it's trying to protect you. has always had something to worry about. That's where the basis of a lot of anxiety is fed from. And that's why we find, I think, it very difficult to give anxiety up, because, you know, we're trying to fight with that part of our mind instead of trying to reason with it. If we're really anxious, our body has a lot of trapped adrenaline in the muscles, because what happens in that split second, say if you're walking down some stairs and the stairs are a bit bigger, you know, you've had that feeling, haven't you? You go down that stair and you go, oh. In that moment, your back of your mind's thinking, no stair, I'm just about stepping off a cliff. And for that moment, you feel that, your stomach jumps, doesn't it? You feel that moment. But also your foot hits the step, hopefully, you know. and then that feeling goes away. But that's that primeval mind showing itself at that moment. Just how amazing it is. In that millisecond, it just decided that could be a dangerous situation. And at that point, it brought up all those physical feelings. So if we're left in a physical state of anxiety that's based from the primeval mind, our body is going to be fueled with adrenaline. Our muscles are going to be full of adrenaline. And that's why a lot of people with anxiety have a lot of physical tension and stress and neck ache and, you know, all those other things that go with it, because their body is locked solid with adrenaline. It's a constant reminder that we feel unsafe.
Mm. You've reminded me of something Ruby Wax talks about quite a lot, that is, now we don't have a predator to run from, now we're trying to avoid a parking ticket. You know, she's like, it's like the traffic warden, and you can't fight or flight, you can't fight him, you also can't run away, because the ticket's already on your car, and yet you can still have that reaction, that kind of rising of emotion, and no outlet for it, because that's the kind of threat we're dealing with nowadays. One other thing I wanted to mention is like a miscellaneous dream example you've reminded me of, as an example of how sometimes even the littlest things can pop up from your subconscious. I tend to have actually very boring dreams, and I to myself at least sell it as a good thing, that maybe I'm getting my creativity out in the waking world. But it means that a lot of my dreams end up being quite simple. So one example of that is, I had one that I've always remembered, which was just waking up in the middle of the night. I could see myself in my bed at my parents' house where I used to live. And I just sat up. I was reading a book that I was reading at the time anyway. And I turned on a light next to me and I just continued reading the book. The most mundane dream. And then it wasn't until I woke up the next day and I realised, that lamp's not there. I've been meaning to get a lamp. And so I actually got on with it and got the lamp I'd been meaning to get for ages. So I thought that was like a silly example of like how sometimes, you know, what's going on in the back of our mind is actually, there's some really clear answers there.
Oh, definitely. And this is what I think we all need to learn to harness more. You know, our unconscious mind is phenomenal. And that's why people say, oh, don't worry, sleep on it, you'll feel better tomorrow. And normally we do, and that's, as I talked about earlier, that processing part of our mind, that's what's happening, you know.
Right, it's no coincidence that you often dream about the same people you'd spent that day with.
Yeah.
You know, you're working through it all.
Yeah, because you need to think, you know, how do we store all this information? We can't gather everything. How do we remember the things that we need to remember and let go of the things that we don't, you know? If I asked you what you had for lunch today, you'd remember. But if I asked you what you had for lunch 6 months ago, you'd be like, I don't know. But if 6 months ago was your birthday and you went out for lunch and it was a different experience and it was out of the normal, you'd go like, oh, yeah, that was my birthday that day. Yeah, we went to there. And you might be able to remember what you had for lunch because it's stored in a different place, and there's not many birthdays, but there's lots of every day. So your mind is always organising that information at night, which is brilliant. And that's the thing with our unconscious. It is like a big library, really. And I think that's where, you know, anxiety, and particularly like PTSD, they have that real issue going on in their library. And I always use this example with my clients that, you know, if you've disconnected from a part of yourself and you can't go there because it's too difficult to deal with, it's like you've left a couple of rows of the library undealt with. So the librarian who wanders around in your library every night as you're dreaming and sleeping can't go in and file it. It's just lobbing the bits of paper over. Eventually that area becomes overfilled. That's when you lose the lid, because then it's going to start spreading out into your the other parts of your life.
That's great. What a great way of explaining it. And so on that, we will round up then. In reference to anxiety, your latest project is books to help kids understand and kind of preemptively build up tools to deal with anxiety should it come up, or if it's coming up already. Could you talk us through that?
Yeah, sure. I think what I started to see, you know, probably about maybe 10 or 12 years ago, that I was starting to see more children coming in for sort of anxieties and teenagers, and hypnosis was great for them because, you know, obviously as an adult, we've got a bit of a predisposition of, you know, whether we believe things or not. As I started working with more and more children, and maybe 10 or 15% of my work is with children and teens, I realised that there wasn't any clear strategies for children to be able to have something concrete that they could take away and fully help them understand, you know, the strategies. Obviously for the adults, I do a blog and they can listen to those things and they can use their recordings. But for children, they really needed something to bring it alive for them, because obviously everything they do is more imagery based. So my first book is out, called Don't Feed the Cat. And it's a story about a cat that is an analogy of our worry habit. And it's about how we can feed our worry habits and turn them into, in the book, it turns into a great big lion. I've used that type of analogy because it's an educational tool. It's not just a story. It's something that, you know, as a parent, the parent can say to their child, oh, you know, can a cat become a lion? And the child at a certain age will go, oh, no, mummy. Okay, so your little worries doesn't have to become this big worry. And there's lots of strategies that are in the book as well. This is the first of a series of four. The second one's due out end of January. It's just being illustrated. There's going to be a lot more information as I'm doing teacher training for a whole array of teachers in schools to help them be able to deliver the book, and different strategies and support strategies for children in school as well, so that they can have a clear way to help children understand their anxieties. And the books are a platform to be able to do that.
Right. And so if people want to buy the book or just learn more about you, where should they go online?
They can buy the book from Amazon. So they just put in Don't Feed the Cat and it will come up. They can find me at hypnosara.blog, and my blog's there. I do a blog, comes out once a week, it's about 10 minutes. It's about different aspects of our mind, and some of them about anxiety, some of them about changing habits.
Grand. Well, thank you so much for joining us
tonight. It's been my pleasure. It's been great speaking to you.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.